Thanks very much, Jerry, and good morning, everyone. It's really a pleasure to be here, in part because it's this community that we seek to work with so much, be they in the U.S. universities, in the private sector, or in international partners like the CGIAR or national programs overseas, many of whom come to these meetings. These are our key partners in delivering the science. And I'm going to focus my comments a little bit beyond just the strategy and really try to position our discussion this morning as part of a global effort to end hunger. The timing is good for this discussion. I can give you an update on a couple things that Jerry mentioned. Also, then I'd like to take most of my talk to outline a couple challenges that, with good news often comes new challenges because it means new expectations. So just a little bit about the positive things that are happening on this list. A key point in Feed the Future is that we put nutrition and agriculture back together. And that puts a human face on our work when we're talking about reducing hunger and extreme poverty. As Jerry said, we have the Global Food Security Act, and I think what's really important right now is what Jerry already mentioned, that the new administration is planning to continue Feed the Future. So this was the hope of many of us. You all are familiar with PEPFAR. That was started under President Bush, continued under President Obama, and now continues under President Trump. So we're very excited that what was once a presidential initiative became a congressional law embraced by the new administration. And to that point, last week was the World Food Prize, and Vice President Pence wrote a letter to the honoree, the laureate, Akin Adesina from the Africa Development Bank. He says, "Congratulations on winning the 2017 World Food Prize. Your devotion to the cause of fighting global hunger is admirable and deeply needed. As our global food system is stretched and the need to feed more people grows, agricultural transformation will require persistence from leaders like you in driving change and capitalizing on public and private sector expertise. On behalf of President Donald Trump, I extend my heartfelt congratulations as you receive this important award. The United States is committed to food security, and we will continue to work with leaders like you to find innovative ways to end global hunger. So that's really something that we're very, very grateful for, to have this signal of support. So just to remind you of what Feed the Future does, and that middle one that's highlighted is going to be the area that we'll be talking about this morning, the research dimension of this. It's always been there. And as you'll later hear from Nora, that we have the new strategy around that. Key points about how we work. Gender infuses our work in part because women are key actors economically and decision makers, but also because women's status and control of assets and income is expressed through better nutrition of the children in the household. So there's many reasons to focus on that. The idea of country ownership, we take our cues from our country partners. You know, if they don't prioritize something, we probably shouldn't either, because it won't be sustainable. And then we have this issue of accountability, where we have been demonstrating that we are having impacts at the level of millions of farmers and millions of children emerging avoiding child stunting. And about accountability, under the GFSA, we have three in the strategy, the Global Food Security Strategy, we have three major outcomes: increased incomes, increased resilience, and increased improved nutrition. And our marker for that, and these are at the population levels, is reduced poverty, extreme poverty, so the $1.25 a day type poverty, increased resilience, and our marker for that is reduced hunger. And I think that's because hunger can drive people to migrate and become refugees or internally displaced persons. And then on nutrition, we have the focus of reduction in child stunting, as I mentioned. Resilience, just to give you a capsule definition. I think it means investing in ways such that shocks do not become crises. In other words, if we can invest now, we can reduce the need for humanitarian assistance. So a lot of our resilience programming is pulling us towards areas that have experienced difficult challenges. So we have new countries, new focus countries like Niger and Nigeria that are dealing with some very challenging issues that affect food security but affect other aspects of their civic life as well. And then on the nutrition side, that's also been re-emphasized under the Global Food Security Act with the inclusion of water and sanitation. And for us, especially the focus on water, which of course has multiple uses in agriculture. So just to show you about how things are improving, you can see over the last 20 years, we're making progress with both undernutrition and extreme poverty. Notice also, though, that Africa is lagging. And then at the bottom of the chart, you'll see how extensive micronutrient deficiency remains. And that's a marker for inadequate diet. So it's not just caloric undernutrition, but also inadequate diets. Now, why agriculture? So it's not just because we like agriculture. It's because agricultural growth is extremely effective, more than any other kind of growth, in reducing poverty. So you can see here that's often more than twice as effective. And why is that? It's because agricultural growth drives the demand for locally produced goods and services. Urban growth can drive the demand for imports. But locally produced goods and services represent opportunities that the poor can often fill. So both on-farm and off-farm employment generation. And then also, agricultural growth is especially effective at reducing hunger. And look at the lower right-hand corner of this, and you can see that there's a negative correlation between growth in the productivity of these key crop and commodity groups with increased caloric intake. So it's a marker for improved consumption as well, particularly among the undernourished. And you can see that the staples and the pulses are particularly effective. But we'll say later while all of these things, like livestock and fruits and vegetables, et cetera, are critical. So thinking about the resilience, which is one new factor that we face, what is more fundamental to farmer resilience than climate and climate change? So I want to say a bit more about that. And this is some work from IRI, from Walter Bathkin and others at Columbia University. And basically, it's a century's worth of data. And what you'll see there is that the trend, while it exists, is not nearly as pronounced as year-on-year variability. So farmers, the people that we're trying to work with in developing countries, their perceptions can often be driven by what they're facing one year and the next, rather than necessarily climate change per se. So it's, this is temperature in this first chart. And then in the second chart, we'll bring in the precipitation, and you can see it's a similar situation, but even less pronounced in terms of long-term trend, or what we would call climate change, and more pronounced in terms of rainfall at the year-on-year variability, 60 to 90% in the upper right-hand corner. So taking this down to a level of a region where resilience is a critical concern, I'm talking about the Sahel here. Let's take a look at the Sahel. That's a century's worth of precipitation data. And you can see that the trend represents a significant amount, the decadal variability even more, and look at the interannual variability. So what are farmers perceiving? They are perceiving a very uncertain climate that, yes, is changing, but there are years now that are wetter than much wetter than some of the driest years a century ago. So they are perceiving this as a sort of a year-on-year change rather than maybe a long-term trend. So the take-home message here, there's the percentages. The take-home message here is that farmers are already ill-adapted to climatic variability in many areas where we work, and they suffer the effects of drought. And here's something from the El Nino drought last year in southern Africa. that wasn't climate change. That's a cyclical thing, and yet it causes devastation, as this woman's farm demonstrates, and as the money the losses also point out to you. So here's where we start to talk response through science. So here's some work that's been going on for many years involving partners from around the world, especially CIMMYT, but also national partners and partners in the U.S. Maize community and elsewhere. And you'll see that these drought-tolerant varieties last year performed much better. You can see the difference between the older variety and the new. Well, these are probably hybrids, I think, that are grown here in Zimbabwe. But then it's not just about genetics. Genetics is huge. It's very important. But then look at the how that improved genetics fared under different systems when it was just grown. And this is all with the same amount of fertilizer. And you can see that when you bring in conservation agriculture, or even better, a legume rotation, which I think we'll hear more about later this morning from Regis, you can see a tremendous impact of how the genetics can actually express themselves across a series of farms. And we're working hard with partners at CIMMYT to really document these things, because this is a very compelling argument to policymakers to show that through improved genetics, agronomy, and management of soil and rotations and so forth, we can really make significant differences that make the outcomes at the individual and community level much better in when facing these kinds of recurrent stressors that we care about to really improve resilience. And then I want to be clear that you know, when we talk about climate, we also think about agricultural additions to climate drivers through greenhouse gas emissions. And of course, there are great opportunities for reducing those, including in the areas that are dark green here, where there's probably overuse of nitrogen fertilizers and hence greater emissions. But look at Africa. I mean, it's basically just the underuse of fertilizer in Africa is absolutely a must change issue going forward. If we are going to come anywhere near achieving the SDGs, or even sooner, the Malabo, the African presidents of all the countries in Africa agreed to double agricultural productivity over the next, they did it a few years ago, and now it's for 2025. So we don't have a lot of time, and it is not going to happen without enhanced use of fertilizers. But we don't have to make the same mistakes that have been made in other areas, and we can do this in a way that actually decreases emissions intensity. In other words, the amount of greenhouse gas per unit product. That's really the key concern here. And in climate science, it's not about reducing the emissions of these very destitute farmers in places like Africa. It's about bending the curve, enhancing their efficiency, and that's very aligned with increased profitability, because you have greater resource use efficiency, your fertilizer giving you a better impact, as we saw in that last slide with the legumes rotation and conservation agriculture. And you're saving money, and you're also saving the environment through both less emissions and also less loss of nitrogen into the water supply or elsewhere. So, and we work a lot on that around policy to try to drive those changes. So let's shift gears now to nutrition. That's our other new challenge, and I'm running out of time quickly, so I'm going to move quickly here. You can see how widespread this problem of child stunting is. This is a marker for chronic undernutrition. And what I want to, one key emphasis here is that we are focused in the upper left. We are focused on the countries where undernutrition and stunting are still highly prevalent. So it's really about that. Now, there are things we can do in those environments to improve that also have salubrious effects on outcomes in urban centers where maybe obesity is starting to become a major problem. But you can see that our focus there is to try to deal with the quality of diet and the also undernutrition. And then just to show the kind of transformation we see here, and when we say rice and veg, I think we also mean legumes there. And you can see how with growing incomes, the diet diversifies, and that's, of course, a key outcome for us. And I'll say more about that, particularly with respect to animal-source foods. But here, just the Lancet series showed that if we do everything right on nutrition, in terms of specific interventions, we will only decrease stunting by 20%. Because other factors are at play. One of them is food. And you can see about a third of the explanation of for improved nutrition is from food. The darker green being calories, the lighter green being non-staples. So here are the quality foods that we said are important. Then water and sanitation, also huge. You can do everything right, but if you don't have clean water, a child will not thrive. Environmental enteropathy, which Shabani will talk more about, will become a problem. And then women's status. Here again, you can see, and that big light blue, which explains most of it, is women's education. So these are really key to the outcomes we're seeking. A little bit about nutrition-sensitive agriculture. So we're trying to make agriculture investments that drive nutrition outcomes. And that's a high bar, and we're still learning, and we rely on our colleagues at Tufts and elsewhere to help us make these outcomes feasible. But one point I want to flag for you there, in addition to the nutrient-rich foods that we focus on as part of that, is the behavior change communication. And that's really a huge piece of it, and I think we'll hear more about that as well. I want to make sure one of the takeaways is that we are trying to help capitalize undercapitalized smallholder systems, including through mechanization and irrigation, again, greatly reducing risk and increasing productivity. That's the sweet spot for us because that will drive investment, both public and private investment, if you raise potential and lower risk. And, of course, irrigation is a great way to do that. And a mechanization, again, which can actually reduce emissions intensity even though you're using more fuel because your yields can go up so much. Not to mention the reduction in drudgery, which is another huge issue for people in the developing world. I just want to remind you that when we talk about irrigation, it's not big fields of irrigated crops. It could be what you see here in terms of forage, in terms of a small patch of vegetables during the dry season with both income and nutrition outcomes. And, of course, multiple-use water systems, which is where the hygiene and water and sanitation intersects with the world of food production and hygienic production systems, very important, especially with things like livestock and poultry and fish. Just a little bit to remind us, you know, we hear a lot of anti-animal agriculture positions in the media, people who are emphasizing eating less meat and so forth, and maybe that's a valid issue in some parts of the world, but we are focusing on people for whom that is still a luxury and for whom the nutrition outcomes, would, particularly of children, would be greatly enhanced, but also of pregnant women and adolescent girls. You really need to be ahead of the curve here on nutrition, and animal source foods are an incredibly important way of doing that. And as you can see, most of them are produced by smallholders. So these are very different from the kinds of issues that shape people's thinking here in the United States and Europe and elsewhere. And of course, these are also great income opportunities for the poor. So I just want to finish with what we should select for as somebody who comes out of a breeding background. New science in crops and livestock, yield gap reduction, really important. I think hopefully we're going to hear some today about these data approaches and things that can reduce, help us understand the environment and reduce the increase our strategic approach to resource management and decision-making. Choices for farmers. This is really about what it is. And we right now, one of the big issues in Africa is the fall armyworm. It's been introduced there. Most countries in Africa don't allow transgenic maize, the ones that have it are fine. The ones that don't are really facing huge problems. So again, there are issues around science policy that come to bear as well. Resource use efficiency, diversification as a way out of poverty, and I think we'll hear more about all of these. Policies, very important to enable this capitalization of these smallholder systems that I talked about. And then finally, this accountability. So thank you very much, and we're really excited to be stepping into this second phase of Feed the Future with you, and appreciate all your partnership as we go forward.